Han Solo knew that something was up when Leia came back to their residence in the middle of the afternoon, but he could never have guessed what she would ask him. Han, I need you to go with the Fifth Fleet on this mission.
What? That's crazy.
It's a bot. I don't know if he really accepts my authority. There isn't anything I can point to justify it. I'm just not sure what he'll do when he's on his own out there.
Why me?
You're the only person I trust completely. And you have all the necessary clearances in place.
Han glowered. He's going to expect me to be in full uniform. I'm going to have to shave every morning.
I know I'm asking a lot, Han. The chances are it'll be a long, boring deployment. I hope it will be.
So why am I going?
Just in case I don't get my wish.
For 22 days, Colonel Peck Picot's little armada had flown station with the Teljikon Vagabond. In all that time, the mystery ship had done nothing to acknowledge their presence. The armada had done its own part to preserve the silence. No messages had been sent to the Vagabond. No active scanners had painted it with energy. No ship had approached closer than 15 kilometers. All that was about to end. The pilotless ferret D-89 had a mission: to breach the perimeter as unaggressively as possible. According to the plan, the ferret would be inside the Vagabond's defense perimeter for less than a second. If the alien vessel tried to jump into hyperspace, the interdiction pickets would be ready to stop it. In the control room, Lando and Colonel Peck Picot watched the numbers roll by as the ferret approached its target. Suddenly, the bridge's speakers began blasting out a wildly modulated sound. It could not be called musical, though there was no other ready word to describe it. To Lando, the sound was both familiar and new. It was the same as the initial monitor ship recording, but much more distinct. For the first time, he could tell that there were two melody lines, something that only signal analyzers had been able to detect before. The signal abruptly ceased. Its job done, D-89 continued out of the intercept area and off the bridge display. Almost at the instant D-89's tracking circle vanished, a brilliant white flash filled all three sections of the display, so intensely that those looking that way were left momentarily blinded. When the flash faded, the Vagabond was gone from the lightning feed, and suddenly smaller in the magnified view.
What was that?
Peck Picot demanded. Target jumped, but the field held it in real space, said his navigator. Target has moved ahead about 3 kilometers. They waited nearly an hour before deciding that nothing else was going to happen. Then Peck Picot ordered the spotter ships to move up and had Glorious brought back to its accustomed position, trailing 15 clicks behind the Vagabond.
The captain's wardroom aboard the Glorious had not been built to accommodate as many bodies as were crowded into it for Peck Picot's briefing. Lando suffered silently through 6 tedious reports on technical data before Peck Picot called for the one which most concerned him.
Foray, Commander, your report on team readiness to enter the Vagabond.
Bijo Hammocks, technically astute and mentally tough, was one of the few officers under Peck Picot's command for whom Lando still had any respect after a month's exposure. Bijo stood.
The team is as ready as can be. We've identified 2 suspected hatchways and a couple of candidate sites in case we have to cut our way in.
Can I assume you'd have no problem being ready for a go order at 1500 hours tomorrow?
None at all, Colonel.
Thank you.
Peck Picot turned toward the other end of the room.
General Calrissian, what can you tell us about the Vagabond's hailing signal?
Well, I can tell you that it's a dual-frequency carrier modulating up to 1,000 times a second. I can tell you that the data capacity is at least 50,000 units. And I can tell you that we still don't know if they're saying halt, or I'll shoot, or welcome to the Cold Space Bazaar, transmit credit information immediately. 3PO knows 6 million forms of communication, and he can't identify it. Have your people had any better luck?
Peck Picot looked down the table for an answer, and a young rating spoke up.
The contact protocol team believes that the signal recorded today is an automated collision alarm. In our opinion, it has no informational content.
Lando leaned forward.
Are you saying that the vagabond jumped to avoid a collision that was never going to happen?
You have another explanation, General?
Packpacott asked.
How about that it was trying to get away from us?
Why would it wait until now to get away?
I'll give you three answers for the price of one. Because some animals freeze first when a predator's nearby. Because until now, we haven't made any aggressive moves. And because we flunked whatever intelligence test it sent us today.
General Calrissian, do you have any clear evidence of informational content in the signal?
No.
Thank you. Captain Hammocks, inform your team that we will begin operations at 1500 hours tomorrow.
All right, said Lando to his team. Tomorrow at 1500 hours, Colonel Packpacott's going to send his brush salesman knocking at the vagabond's door. We're running out of time to offer the Colonel any alternatives. Let's do some serious brainstorming.
Hours later, Lando sighed impatiently.
Think, everyone, think. You want to lock up a spaceship you're sending out to the great nowhere. You want to make sure no outsider can get in uninvited, but you and yours always have access. You don't want to use a physical key because you don't want to let anyone that close without checking them out. So, we're talking about a password, basically. A really long binary passcode.
Forgive me, Master Lando, but in my experience, no sentient being could remember a password of this length and complexity, said 3PO.
Well, the answer might not be as long as the question, Lando began.
It could be longer, said Lobot.
That's not the point. Maybe the question only looks long and complex because we don't understand it. Human beings can remember incredibly long sequences if they have meaning. I knew a smuggler who'd memorized 100 prescriptions of Velcetus when he was a kid taking religious training, and he could still rattle them off 30 years later. And there are species with much better memories than human beings.
I don't dispute that, said Lobot. Even so, passwords and access codes, whether mathematical or linguistic, are not error-tolerant. No matter how long the expected response may be, it must contain no errors.
Well, that's always the problem, isn't it? How do people remember all the things they have to remember? What do they do when there's something they can't allow themselves to forget? They cheat.
Mnemonics.
Yes, but they cheat in other ways, too. They carry the passcodes with them.
Lando started to pace.
Come on, come on. We're getting close to something here. Where's the missing piece?
What about the fact that there are pairs of tones in the transmission?
Asked Lobot.
Lando rubbed his hands together.
Good. Good. But are they pairs, or is it two separate channels of information? Think, Lobot. Think.
Lobot could not have explained how he listened to the stream of data that passed through his consciousness in the next few seconds. In the early days of his training, he had imagined himself creating a sieve to place in the torrent, which would catch only the information he sought. But all metaphors ultimately failed. All he could say now was that he sent out his thoughts and brought back an answer.
Long, non-random sequences are found in most genetic codes. The code for a single molecule would meet these conditions.
All right, how many pairs are there in the fragment?
18.
How many species have 18 different molecular pairs in their genetic code?
Lobot lowered his eyes for a moment, searching for the answer.
There are 6 recorded species with 18 pair genetic structures.
Do any of the 6 have a pitch-based language?
1. The Kela. I am passing the genetic sample library marker to R2-D2 for analysis.
After several seconds, the droid had an answer.
What? Demanded Lando. What is it?
R2 says that there is a 99.9% certainty that the signal from the ship is a representation of a segment of the genetic code of the Kela. But the sequence ends in the middle. It's not complete.
Of course not, said Lando. That's the answer they're expecting. The rest of the sequence. R2, can you sing the next fragment?
Master Lando, an R2 unit has only a simple vocabulator, said 3PO. But if I may offer my assistance...
Give it a try.
For several seconds, 3PO and R2 huddled together over the droid transmission channel, passing information in binary. Then 3PO straightened up, looked toward Lando, and cocked his head. The droid's rendition of the vagabond's hailing signal was distinctively different, but unmistakably the work of the same composer.
All right! Lando punched the air with a fist. That's the key! We're going in the front door.
3PO, Lobot, tell me all about the Kella.
I have been accessing all records available to me, said Lobot. It seems that the Kella have been extinct for more than 150 years.
A few minutes before 1300 hours, Lando and Lobot slid into the cockpit of Lady Luck.
I figure we have 12 seconds minimum before they try to get a lock on us, said Lando. I intend to be inside No Man's Land by then.
The moment Lady Luck disengaged from the docking ring, alarms began to sound on the bridge of Glorious.
Lando heard the voice of Pak-Pakot.
General, what do you think you're doing out there?
Research. I'd make sure I was recording this if I were you.
Turn your ship about, General. This is your last warning.
At that moment, the bridge was filled with the sounds of the vagabond's keening chorus.
Get a tractor beam on that ship, and I mean now.
Lando's face was tight with anxiety.
Ready now, 3PO? Use every band you have.
Lando held his breath and waited. Lobot glanced sideways at the display.
There's a secondary shield up. The Glorious's tractor beam has been deflected. We have been recognized. We have left the Colonel's armada and joined the Kella.
In the early morning of the Fifth Fleet's departure from Coruscant, a dark blue bubble-top fleet speeder reached the entry gate at Admiral Ackbar's residence on Victory Lake. It slowed only briefly, then was waved through. Admiral Ackbar himself met the visitor at the door.
Ah, Ichan, come in. Thank you for coming. There is someone I want you to meet.
Ackbar led the way into a round-walled inner room.
Hiram, this is Ichan Abbat. Ichan, Hiram Drayson is the director of Alpha Blue. Have you heard that name before?
No.
Good. You should not have until now. Hiram and Alpha have a charter that recognizes the ambiguities of war and politics and inherit the jobs which require working outside the rules of polite society.
Diplomatically put, said Drayson, smiling pleasantly.
Hiram has some information for you, Ichan. I would listen to him carefully. And now I will say good night.
Wait, where are you going?
Asked Abbat.
This conversation is not meant for my ears. I am going to the water column to sleep.
Drayson began without formalities. I've been trying for months to establish some assets in the Kurnak cluster. It hasn't been easy. Apparently, the Yavetha have a straightforward method of dealing with trespassers. They execute them on sight.
They like their privacy.
Perhaps a little too much, which is consistent with the behavior of the Viceroy here. The Yavetha stay in their ship, and the Viceroy limits his outside contacts to a few hours every other day with Leia. I don't know if there are 10 of them in there or 1,000.
You don't trust them either?
No, I don't. I'm certain that Nil Spar has been lying to Leia.
Is that why you're having this conversation with me instead of with the princess?
That's one reason. The other is that you're going out there with 30 warships and she's not.
Grayson rubbed his eyes.
And here's something I keep thinking about. The Yavetha had just achieved interplanetary spaceflight at the time of the general survey. The species is very bright, technically clever, rather proud of themselves, but no threat to anyone.
Then the Empire shows up.
and puts the Yveatha to work in Imperial shipyards, building and repairing vessels which represent a big leap beyond what the Yveatha had been doing on their own. Whether or not the Yveatha acquired any ships or shipyards from the Empire, they almost certainly acquired the knowledge of how to build them.
They could have created their own Black Fleet.
Indeed. Let me ask you a question, General. Do you trust Leia's judgment where the Viceroy and the Yveatha are concerned?
Abbott looked away.
That's why you and I are having this meeting. I want you to come back without ever having had to open your gun ports. But if you do have to open them, I want you to know who you're trying to kill and why.
Is that all? I have people waiting for me.
No. There's one more thing. I understand you know Kyles LaToth, the Associate Director of the Astrographic Survey Institute.
We served together in the Dornian Navy.
More than that, you were friends. Perhaps he even owes you a favor.
You know too much. What are you getting at?
The Institute is a long way from the Fleet Office or the Palace. It must be nice not to have everyone breathing down your neck. And they've been given everything they need, a whole fleet of astrographic and survey vessels.
Abbott stared, struck silent.
Maybe you should call him before you leave, Drayson suggested softly.
Standing inside the hatch of the four-seat shuttle he had flown up to the Glorious, General Han Solo tugged unhappily at the stiff fabric of his uniform, trying to make it more comfortable. The flight deck crew already had an egress ladder in place for him, and the deck officer was waiting at the bottom of it.
Lieutenant, Han said, permission to come aboard.
General Solo, sir. Granted. Welcome aboard. I hadn't heard that you were coming to see us off, sir.
I'm not. Han descended the ladder. I'm coming along for the ride. Have my gear brought off the shuttle, and then get one of your ferry pilots to take this thing back to the station, would you?
Yes, sir, right away.
The lieutenant looked at Han with the slightly worshipful eagerness he had learned to expect, but never to accept.
I'm just sorry you didn't come up in the Falcon, sir. I would have liked to see her.
I'd kind of like to see her right now myself. Where is General Abbott?
The general's not aboard, sir. We're expecting him at any time. I could show you to the bridge.
Han tugged at the tight collar of his shirt.
If you could just find out where my quarters are, that would do for now. Oh, and let me know when General Abbott comes aboard.
Han was asleep in his quarters on board the Glorious when he was startled awake by a sharp noise. Sitting bolt upright, he found a tall Dornian in a fleet command uniform looming over him. The age lines on the Dornian's face showed him to be over 100 years old. The bars on his jacket showed that he was General Abbott.
General Solo,
Abbott said.
There's a rumor all over the ship that I'm out and you're in. Want to tell me what that's about?
Han swung his feet over the side of the bunk.
I don't know what that's about. You're the commander of the Fifth Fleet. Nothing's changed.
Why are you here, if not to replace me?
I thought you could figure that one out on your own.
I do not enjoy the princess's full confidence.
Right. But I do. So if I tell her everything's fine, she'll believe it.
If you're not here to replace me, are you here to find her a reason to do so?
I'm here to help you not do anything stupid. If it turns out you don't need any help with that, that's fine with me. I'll sharpen up my Barlaz game in your rec hall, find out where your quartermaster keeps the medicinal dragon juice, and catch up on my sleep. I'm not here to make your job harder.
By the time Colonel Pac-Picot reached a comm station, the Lady Luck had moved to within 2 kilometers of the Vagabond and was closing at a rate that would place it alongside in a matter of minutes. The sight of it brought the threat ruffles on Pac-Picot's back to full flourish, and his throat turned crimson, a display no one in his bridge crew had ever seen before.
Calrissian, You're a madman. You will lose more than your commission over this, I promise you that.
Colonel, I'll take that as your promise to do everything you can to help keep me alive long enough to satisfy your fine sense of outrage.
Packpacot fumed.
You obviously came here with secret information about this vessel, which you denied to us.
Secret information? What are you blathering about, Colonel?
You as much as admitted it. You knew that the target was expecting her countersign, which you already possessed.
Colonel, we didn't have any secret information. We simply happened to look in the right place in the Imperial Archives, and just barely in time, too. Now we're in, and we're going to do what we can while we're here.
Since making its pass at the Vagabond the day before, D-89 had been flying formation with the Glorious, awaiting its next job as the second spotter platform for the long-range stereo recordings to be made of the 4A team's contact. When its real space engine suddenly roared to life, it had only a few kilometers to cover before reaching the invisible boundary of the Vagabond's security sphere. D-89 was still accelerating when the Vagabond hailed it. A signal heard on board the Lady Luck and the Glorious as well. Lobot was the first to realize the cause.
There's another vessel approaching the Vagabond.
Almost at the same time, 3PO said,
Master Lando, that's not the same sequence.
I know, I can hear it. I was afraid he was going to try this.
The signal from the Vagabond ended, and the response began, relayed from the Glorious through D-89's own transmitters. But even before the response was complete, a fierce blue light began dancing over the entire aft third of the Vagabond's hull.
Hold on, everyone!
Lando threw himself across the console, reaching for the control that would boost the Lady Luck's combat shields with the full output of her engines.
But his hand had not reached the switch before the cockpit was flooded with a light so harsh that even 3PO flinched from it.
One by one, Lando silenced the alarms. The ship seemed unharmed, even untouched.
What was that?
I'm showing an explosion 8 kilometers aft of us, said Lobot. It was the ferret D-89. No one was on board.
With a touch on the console, Lando signaled the cruiser.
Colonel, one of these days, you're going to learn to stop ignoring what I tell you.
Anytime you care to start telling me the truth, General, I will be happy to listen. The Vagabond allowed you to approach, and now it's protecting you.
General, the challenge to the ferret was different from the challenge to us. Probably to stop someone from doing exactly what you tried to do, namely snoop and steal the key. If the Vagabond's protecting us, it's only because it thinks we belong here.
R2 and 3PO had been having their own conversation at the rear of the yacht's flight deck, and now 3PO stepped forward to where Lando and Lobot sat.
Sir?
Wait, 3PO.
Sir, R2 says that the new sequence sent by the Keller vessel does not appear in the information from the survey archives.
What?
R2 says he is unable to determine what the correct response might be.
Lando shook his head.
I feel like I'm in a spelling bee, and the kid in front of me just went out on a word I don't know either.
Colonel, are you getting all this?
Getting it? Yes. Understanding it? No.
We match the original signal from the Vagabond to the genetic code of a species called the Kella. The correct response was the next portion of the code, but it interrogated the ferret with a different sequence, and we don't know what comes next.
With the Lady Luck cruising slowly along the hull of the Vagabond at a distance of only 100 meters, Lando saw the ship clearly for the first time. At a distance, the hull seemed lumpy and irregular. Up close, it looked like nothing so much as a massive tree trunk with thick crisscrossing vines which had grown into the metallic bark. But the vines were large enough to park the yacht in, and the trunk would easily have swallowed the cruiser.
Maybe those extrusions are some sort of energy conduit for the weapons, said Lando. I can't see anything else that looks like a weapon.
Lando, said Lobot suddenly, look. The surface of the Vagabond had suddenly come alive with small, pale patches of light. They appeared and disappeared in orderly patterns along the top of the hull extrusions, forming sequences that drew the eye forward, then to the edge of the curving hull where they disappeared.
Oh no, R2, look out! It's getting ready to fire again!
3PO exclaimed.
There is another possibility, said Lobot. This could be the next question for us.
Kakpakat's voice came forcefully over the comlink.
General, I strongly suggest you drop the limpet and get your people out of there.
No. I want to know what's happening on the rest of the hull, the part we can't see. Where do the lights go, Lobot?
I am monitoring.
3PO, can you make anything out of this?
I do not recognize this as any form of language known to me, Master Lando. But perhaps it is not linguistic, but symbolic communication.
What are you talking about?
Sir, perhaps they are pointers. Might I suggest that you follow them backwards to the point of divergence?
Lando reached for the thruster controls. At the spot from which the light seemed to appear, a dark hole irised open, and the lights vanished.
They're inviting us inside, said Lobot.
Well, I'll be the last pup of an ion storm, Lando breathed.
So they are, Lobot.
So they are. Let's suit up.
The yacht's outer airlock and the opening in the Vagabond's hull were mismatched in both shape and size. The solution was an old invention which Lando had made standard equipment on all his vessels, an extensible cofferdam. Flexible yet vapor-tight, the enclosure could telescope out from the hull of Lady Luck and attach itself to the other ship, forming a tunnel between the airlocks. Lando locked the helmet of his suit in place with a twist as the cofferdam extended and pressurized.
Looks like a good seal, he said. Pressure is holding.
Kakpakat, reduced now to the role of spectator, sent a last message.
Good luck, General. I envy you.
The cofferdam had rigid rings with handholds spaced at intervals, which Lando used to propel himself through the 5-meter-long tunnel between the ships. He paused outside the Vagabond's portal to switch on his suit and helmet lights. The lights revealed little detail inside the Keller vessel, only an empty space enclosed by blank walls of the same mottled color as the hull itself. Grasping the upper rim of the opening, Lando floated himself through, twisting to look in all directions.
All right, I'm in. This chamber is about twice my height in every dimension. Plenty of room for all four of us. No response to my presence yet. There's no light, and there doesn't seem to be another doorway.
He paused for a moment.
Wait. That's odd. I don't know why or how, but I can see the attachment ring through the bulkhead. There's a shadow, exactly that size, visible on the inside.
Lobot checked his display.
Not visible on the relay. Are you saying that the hull is translucent, Lando?
Well, yes.
Lando brushed his gloved fingertips across the surface. He could feel that the shadow was slightly raised.
R2, Lobot, 3PO, why don't you come on over and see what you can make of this? Maybe there's something about the modeling on the walls, Lando said, as R2 investigated the spot on the wall and Lobot hovered beside him.
Maybe if we touch the right pattern of spots. Have you ever seen Donati's stain painting?
No, I haven't. What's that got to do with anything?
To human perception, stain painting consists of huge canvases covered with random splotches of color. The Donati sit and stare at a painting for 10 minutes or more at a time. They begin to meditate and end up in a state of high rapture. R2 is the only one of us capable of seeing the entire chamber at once. He can reprocess the image according to the parameters I provide and project it for us to see.
It is said on Gaios that a seed does not know the flower that produced it. What is true of seeds and flowers is true of civilizations and worlds. In the long history of the galaxy, many a family tree has grown too tangled to be clearly remembered by either ancestor or descendant. The people who called themselves the Kella had no children of their own. They did, however, have parents, parents they scarcely remembered, but to whom much of what they were and knew could be traced. The parents of the Kella had called themselves the Kone, and they had had many offspring, as had their parents, who called themselves the Arunafi. So, although the Kella had no children, they had siblings in some number, and cousins close and distant in numbers beyond counting. It was with the hope of finding such kin as the Kella might have that Lobot sifted the archives of the Institute for Sentient Studies. He knew no more about the family history of the Kella than did the Kella themselves, but he knew the patterns and principles that applied. His hope depended not on luck, but on a well-chosen search algorithm. The thoroughness of the archivists, and the fruitfulness and resilience of the Arunafi line. Or at least so Lobot would forever claim. Luck was Lando's game, and Lobot preferred to distance himself from anything so ephemeral and unpredictable. It was a silent rivalry, and Lobot took unvoiced pleasure from the times when Lando's way failed him, and Lobot's own way succeeded. He prided himself on playing a more precise and controlled line, where competence counted for more than chance, and diligence was rewarded more often than daring. This time, the reward was the mind prints of a man named Konai. The image R2 was projecting covered only part of one wall, but incorporated the patterns of the entire chamber as they would have been perceived by a Kella.
"There," said Lando, "in that corner. There's your big red switch."
Pushing off from the equipment sled 3PO had brought, he floated toward the corner. But although Lando pushed on the handle several times, it would not budge. Then R2 tried, also to no avail. Realizing the handle might be temperature-sensitive, Lando tugged the glove off his right hand and reached out to touch the freezing cold bulkhead. It retreated under his touch, the surface folding back on all sides until there was a hole deep enough that Lando was uncertain whether he could reach the farthest recesses.
"He did it!"
3PO exulted. Lando peered into the opening.
"There's some sort of handle back here."
Drawing a deep breath, he reached in with his bare hand. There was a flash of brilliant blue light outside the portal, and when it was gone, so was the tunnel to Lady Luck's airlock. In the next instant, the atmosphere in the chamber began boiling out into space, sweeping everything and everyone toward the open portal. Lando clung desperately to the handle, though he lost his grip on the glove and watched it being whisked away beyond his reach. But R2, Lobot, and 3PO spun crazily toward the opening. The glove, far lighter and moving faster than any of the party, struck the outer bulkhead and tumbled out into space. But bare moments before R2 reached the opening, there was suddenly no opening. As neatly as the portal had opened under Lando's touch, it knitted itself closed.
"The ship's moving!" Lando cried, feeling the acceleration pressing him more firmly against the aft bulkhead. "Hammocks! Colonel, what's going on?"
There was no answer, not even static.
"Anyone on the Glorious, respond!"
"Lando, all my links are gone. We're not just moving. This ship just jumped into hyperspace."
Long before they reached Lukazek, Luke Skywalker settled on Mud Sloth as the name for Akana's previously unnamed Verpine adventurer, because the craft was so slow. At Akana's suggestion, they adopted a watch schedule which had them sleeping at opposite ends of the day so that each would have more privacy. Akana read from a battered old datapad, meditated in the co-pilot's couch, and intently studied the adventurer's owner, pilot, and system programs. They did take meals together, dipping twice a day into her modest cache of stabilized food stores, many of them long-expired Imperial expedition packs, a telltale sign of desperately tight finances. During a meal they shared near the end of the journey, Luke tore open a pouch of Noryoth brown meat bread.
16 more hours. I hate the waiting.
Do you think there's any chance the Felonasi may have come back after the war?
No,
said Akana. You see, the Empire feared as well as coveted our power. They didn't come down with weapons drawn to round us up as they did with so many other populations they enslaved. We were divided among ourselves about the coming war and what our moral duty was. The Imperial Governor General Tag came to Wialu, the woman who held the Wand of Privilege. He said it was important for us to show our loyalty to the Empire, that that was the only way we could escape the fate of the Jedi. We knew they were being hunted down as traitors and sorcerers. Wialu refused General Tagger. She told him that the loyalty of the Felonasi was to the light.
Tagger, I remember now, said Luke. He was on the first Death Star when Leia was a prisoner.
He paused.
He was probably still on board when my proton torpedo blew it to bits. Luke didn't know what possessed him to make that claim before Akana, and her response made him feel even more foolish for having done so. She stiffened as he spoke, and he could feel her withdraw from him.
Do you seek honor from me for this? In time you will understand that the Felonasi honor no heroes for killing, not even killing one who has been our tormentor, said Akana.
I'm sorry. Luke wondered at his own words. Everything suddenly seemed upside down. It was strange and unsettling that the deed for which he had been so lionized, killing an enemy who had been his own sister's tormentor, had now become touched with regret. That moment had decided both his future and the galaxy's, and he had never in all the years since questioned the rightness of what he had done. Akana nodded, and her face seemed to soften.
I will not speak of it again.
Luke was happy to leave behind his unthinking words and the jumbled thoughts and alarming feelings that had followed them. How did the Empire respond to Wialu? Is that when you left Lukasik?
No, not until later, said Akana. Taga then tried to force us to come to him by destroying our relationship with our neighbors. We shopped in villages near ours and hired workers from them. Taga placed agents in those villages to kill house animals, set fires, turn the waters bitter, and make other strange things happen.
And then blame the Felonasi, Luke guessed.
Yes. That was when my mother sent me away. Not to protect me, because she and the others could protect the children well enough, but she didn't want to expose me to the hate that surrounded us. They were to send for us when Lukasik was peaceful again, or come for us when they headed for a new home.
But they never did.
No. I never heard from any of the body again.
The region of Lukasik that Akana called the North Plateau had no true spaceport. Luke was directed to set the mud sloth down at a quiet little airfield, identified only by its latitude and longitude. There he and Akana were met by three men wearing drab brown clothing, who identified themselves as the airfield marshal, the district censor, and the port magistrate. The censor had a small recorder.
Point of origin?
Coruscant, said Luke.
Purpose of your visit?
Research, said Akana. Archaeological research.
No digging is permitted without a license from the Proctor of History,
the magistrate warned them.
All artifacts must be submitted to the office of the proctor.
Of course, Luke said.
His gaze settled on the censor. Was there anything else? The man puffed up his chest.
I must see your identity cards, of course.
Luke intensified his focus on the man.
We've already shown them to you.
The censor's eyes were suddenly blank.
Of course. You'll want to hire a cart. Go by the East District Trail. The bridge at Crown Pass Road has been out since the last rain.
They jolted along over the rutted road in one of the big-wheeled, two-seated utility vehicles common on Lukasik, passing no other vehicle or person along the way. In its heyday, Yaltra, the village of the Felonasi, had had more than 30 buildings. The Circle House had stood three stories high with a great open archway and tiled facings in complex abstract designs. Its rooftop gardens, fed by pipe and solar pump, offered not only lush grass and flowers, but a view over the surrounding hills. Medicinal and food crops once grew under three translucent domes nestled between pairs of small workhouses. Ring dwellings had been scattered everywhere, each with half a dozen sleeping cottages surrounding the common rooms. Yaltra had enjoyed two wells and a walled pond, and a long wandering meditation trail with more than a dozen hillside shelters. None of it remained untouched. The Circle House had collapsed into rubble. The growing domes had been exploded from within. Fragments of the clear crystalline material littered the ground everywhere, crunching under Luke and Akana's feet. The walled pond had been breached and was bone dry. The well had been filled with masonry. Akana stood by one dwelling, biting her lower lip. Anguish radiated from her with such intensity that Luke found it necessary to shield himself.
This was our home, she said at last.
Luke waited outside, granting Akana privacy in the ruins of her memories. She rejoined him a few minutes later, standing taller and seeming stronger.
They weren't here when this happened, she said. Whether they were taken or escaped, none of them died here.
Why do you say that? Luke asked.
Because of the way it feels here. I don't know quite how to describe it, except that I'm sure that I'd be able to feel it if even one of us had been killed here. This was an empty gesture.
It feels that way to me, too. And I'd vote for escaped. I think they desecrated your home because that was all they could do. He paused.
Akana? Which was my mother's house?
Akana closed her eyes in thought for a moment, then pointed across the compound.
Number four. Go on. I'm all right.
Nodding his appreciation, Luke turned and started toward the ruined ring dwelling at the foot of the highest of the enclosing hills. But he was not even halfway there when a scream froze him. He whirled, his cape sweeping outward, and a blaster bolt burned past him, so close that he could smell the heat. He rolled away from it, came out of the roll with a forward flip that carried him 5 meters away from where he had stood, and ended the flip searching for his attacker, lightsaber in his hand. There were two men near Akana, who was huddled on her knees with an arm raised as though she had just fended off a blow. Akana! Luke charged toward them. The next blaster bolt was dead on target. But Luke deflected it neatly skyward with his lightsaber. He drew deeply on the force and reached out to crush the blaster with a thought as powerful as a vice. His next thought yanked the disabled weapon from the man's hand and hurled it out of reach. Seeing what he was doing, Akana shouted,
"No, Luke, don't!"
But Luke's focus was on the second man, who was also pointing a weapon at Akana.
"Keep your distance!" the man shouted at Luke.
Luke's answer was a thought blow that tore the blaster from the man's hand and smashed it against the wall of the dwelling behind him. It shattered into a dozen fragments. Then he was on them, the lightsaber held for attack, not defense. The first man he had disarmed projected a personal shield which blunted Luke's initial stroke. The blow took the man to his knees all the same. The next stroke sliced through the shield and deep into the assailant's chest. He gasped, then crumpled onto the ground. Turning quickly, Luke found the second man reaching for Akana, as though meaning to use her as his shield. Luke threw his lightsaber, spinning the weapon end for end with a sharp snap of his wrist. It scythed through the air, severing the attacker's left arm above the elbow. The man screamed and collapsed as Luke brought the lightsaber back to his hand. "Who are you?" Luke demanded, standing over the fallen attacker.
"Commander Paffin reporting. Skywalker..."
With a flick of his lightsaber, Luke disabled the comm unit on the man's equipment belt.
"Who are you? Why are you here?"
"Not fair. Waited so long. We only expected the witch."
"Why were you waiting? What did you want?"
"They said the poison wouldn't hurt."
Then the man died, still staring at the sky. Luke crouched beside Akana, who was still huddled on the ground, shaking from head to toe and sobbing.
"Akana, are you hurt?"
She recoiled violently from his touch. I wasn't in danger. There was no reason for what you did.
What I did? I thought you were in trouble.
Couldn't you have protected us without harming them?
Luke extended his awareness, searching the ruins, the hills. We'll have to talk about this later. Those were Imperial agents. There's no telling how close their friends are. We have to leave.
But would the Empire risk sending a ship this deep into New Republic territory?
That depends on how badly someone still wants the Falanasi, Luke said. I don't think we should wait around to see.
Akana calmed herself and rose. Very well. On the wall of the house I saw a symbol that my mother left for me. It tells where we must go next. But here's one more thing. You need to go inside your mother's cottage.
He shook his head sadly. There isn't time.
Take the time.
Luke sat in the middle of the ruined cottage and whispered his mother's name as if to ask the broken stones if they remembered it.
Nashira.
But the sound fled into the dark corners and vanished. He brushed the litter aside and pressed the palms of his hands to the floor, drew the dusty air deep into his nostrils, and tasted it on his tongue.
Mother.
The reality of the moment welled up inside him. It was a point of contact after so many years without one. She had been where he was now. It did not matter that he could not find her touch lingering on the rude substance surrounding him. The knowledge alone was enough.